Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the BWX Limited Investor Update. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Rory Gracian, Group CEO and MD. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'd like to start by acknowledging and apologising for the delay in reporting our FY22 results. While we understand and appreciate the frustration from our shareholders, it was imperative that the audit process was completed accurately, which did take additional time, specifically in relation to prior period revenue restatements and impairment calculations. We do thank you all for your patience as our team continues to implement our financial and operational reset. I'm joined today by our new interim CFO, Mr. Beryl Akdogan, and we'll be co-presenting today. Before I do start going through the results, I would also like to welcome Mr. Stephen Fisher, our new chair of BWX, and invite him for some opening remarks.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the call. Clearly, it's my first morning on the job, and I don't have a lot to say about the results, but I would like to say that I don't think there are that many Australian companies with such strong brands and with such strong international presence. I think that the opportunity for BWX is enormous, and I think once the fundamentals are reset, the board's renewed and the executive are strengthened, I think this company has a great prospect, and I look forward to leading it and making this a great company. So please be patient, but things will happen on the other side. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen. There's a lot to take in today, and we recognise you'll have questions, which we'll address at the end. With that said, let's begin the overview of the results and further updates we've lodged with the ASX today. Turning now to slide number two, FY22 results summary. For the 22 full financial year on a statutory basis, statutory revenue was $198.3 million, and we reported an EBITDA loss of $6.4 million. BWX delivered an NPAT loss of $335.6 million, which includes a $322.6 million non-cash impairment charge that relates to carrying value assessment of intangibles. We will go through and explain the impairment shortly, but it's important to note that that write-down of goodwill is non-cash in nature and has no impact on our debt facilities. The statutory result was also impacted by the $6.2 million cost of equity Chemist Warehouse partnership expense. Excluding those non-cash one-offs, on an underlying basis, BWX delivered revenue of $204.5 million and an underlying EBITDA loss of $0.2 million, an underlying NPAT of $7.1 million. Our net debt position pre-AASB 16 at 30 June was $64.3 million. We reported a negative operating cash flow for the year, negative 22.2, as a result of elevated inventory levels, acquisition costs, and tax contribution of $9.6 million. Of which we do expect to receive $8.3 million back in FY23 via loss carryback rules. We have experienced elevated inventory levels, which are up $19.1 million on prior period for a number of reasons. To safeguard the smooth transition to our new manufacturing facility, the decision to stop investment buys, and the added effect of retail partners winding down their own pandemic safety inventory, as well as inventory from acquisitions. Needless to say, we're very focused on getting our inventory down to more sustainable levels, and I'll explain our approach further in the strategy and outlook session. Non-cash impairments. As I noted earlier, we have written down the carrying value of intangible assets. Our F22 performance was lower than expected. Across the segments, growth rates we had in previous impairment models have been revised down to reflect post-COVID conditions, also taking into account retail spending uncertainty and current trading. The write-downs will support the company to reset growth expectations of our brands and our e-commerce platform to more prudent levels going forward, and we'll talk about them in more detail later on. As it relates to prior period restatements, as we've flagged previously, we have restated revenue and earnings to both FY21 and the first half FY22 financial statements. We do acknowledge the revenue recognition accounting errors, resulted in the need for these restatements. A more extensive explanation can be found in the appendix on slide 29 and 30 of the presentation. But as a result of that restatement, FY21 revenue has been revised down by $11 million and EBITDA by $8.8 million. And first half 22 revenue has been revised down by $5.7 million and EBITDA by $5.3 million as it moves into the second half. I do want to emphasize that together with Beryl, we've planned and established extensive improvements on financial policies, controls and procedures to prevent a recurrence. Turning now to our operational and segment performance. Our segment revenue was $89.5 million for Australian International, impacted by a decision to stop unsustainable investment buys, $76.8 million for the USA business segment, with Andalou, which we flagged previously, impacted by the manufacturing transition in-house and Mineral Fusion, has been showing strong growth. $32 million for digital, partly impacted by the manufacturing transfer as well as post-COVID online retail conditions. Our brands continue to perform well in market, with scan data for the rolling 12 months to end of July reflecting growth in market value share. Seekin's value share across its combined categories grew 12% year-on-year versus the total category growth of 3%. Mineral Fusion's value growth grew at 19% versus the category growth of 10%. And Andalou Natural's share did decline in facial skin by 7% versus the total category declining at 1%. And that is explained through the considerable pause in promotional activity while we transferred manufacturing from the US to Australia. The segment margins were impacted by increased marketing, people and acquired business expenses. In response, we've taken action to implement clear and actionable cost out and cost control programs across the business in the second half of the year. From a strategic action point of view, we did undertake a number of strategic actions to reset the business and make sure we have maintainable and sustainable cash flows and earnings going forward. In July, we completed a $23.2 million capital raise in order to accelerate debt reduction and to improve the balance sheet. We set up strict financial processes across the company with $10 million in group-wide annualised cost savings executed, including a trade spend program and a 15% reduction in people costs. From April through to June, we reduced $5 million in inventory and expect to implement further inventory rundown as retail partner inventory levels gradually wind down. We are executing an organisational restructure to improve financial reporting processes and support the execution of our strategic plan. And we're progressing a strategic view of our non-core assets to accelerate the deleveraging of the group. As you're aware, we've completed the full removal of investment buys and unsustainable sales practices in the organisation, and we have a finance structure process and capability reset that is underway with Bureau now joining. Turning now to some other important post-30 June developments. With board renewal, we have also updated on the board renewal process, which we are committed to and commenced in June. Mr. Stephen Fisher has been appointed to BWX's new chair. Mr. Fisher has more than 30 years of board and management experience in the wholesale goods industry and serves as non-executive chair of the Reject Shop and the Lay-By Group. He's also a former chairman of Breville, and we're looking forward to having a chair of his calibre joining us. Mr. Ian Campbell has retired his role of chair, but remains on the board as a non-executive director through to the AGM. And both Ms. Fiona Bennett and Mr. Rod Walker have resigned their NED board positions as part of the previously announced board renewal process. Moving to outlook, we're expecting our FY23 revenue now to be in the range of $205 to $230 million in revenue and EBITDA in the range of $25 to $30 million. The first half of FY23, we've seen our performance impacted by high restructuring, advisor costs, and by the short-term liquidity challenges. Reductions in promotions and elevated customer-held inventory have impacted the half. However, it's important to remember this is not a consumer issue, and at the same time, we've seen category growth in Australia and the USA above prior periods. This gives us confidence in BWX's core business and the opportunity ahead as inventory levels normalise within our retail partners and sales level improve in the second half of this year. I'll now hand over to Beryl for a more in-depth look at our financial performance.
Thanks, Rory, and good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us. What I want to focus on this slide is the table to the right, which does a deeper dive into our financials. And at first glance, it's got some numbers that are, I guess, heading in the wrong direction for us, but they do need to be understood in the context of what we've done. And so what I might do is take you through individual line items and explain those to you to give you greater insights. So the revenue line is up 8.3%. but that's been diminished by an equity-linked payment for a strategic partnership with a key customer. That charge of $6 million really is we consider that as an abnormally high one-off type expense. And so we normalise for that to bring our revenue up to $204 million, and that's about an 11% increase year over year. That actually, whilst on the face of it, looks like a good result. In actual fact, our underlying revenues have fallen. That increase has been driven by acquisitions. However, our business did not meet the revenue targets for the year, and in some geographies actually went backwards. And we'll tackle that and what that means for the business. But in essence, that drove things like the impairment charge and resulted in the underperformance of the business. So that's the revenue line. We should also call out the gross profit line, which is $105.4 million. Now, we've got, within that number, we took an additional inventory charge for slow-moving and obsolescent stock of $5 million against the prior year. And that was partly because of the elevated stock position that we're sitting on, and also because of the our failure to meet our sales targets, and so we naturally took a more aggressive stance there. The point I wanted to emphasise ultimately was the gross profit margin line. So we can see a deterioration from 58 to 53%. If we add back the Chemist Warehouse charge and the impact of slow-moving and obsolete stock, that actually moves it back up towards the 58, 59% mark. And so I think that's a better way to be looking at the business as a starting point. And certainly we have plans to grow that beyond that level, but that's an important one for everyone to understand. And then we look at the operating cost line, and there is a significant increase year over year from 83.3 to 112 million. A large portion of that are acquisition driven, but we also know that we had invested in people and costs for a much larger business. And when that did not eventuate, we had to revisit those costs. And so there is an action underway, which has already been initiated, to reduce headcount and people-related costs by about $10 million. But within the FY22 results, we also incurred a significant doubtful debts charge of $3 million. You'll see in the annual report that our audit fee has also jumped by $1.6 million year over year as a result of the accounting errors and other issues we've faced. So net-net, there's about $14.5 to $15 million of expenditure that will come out of that operating expense line as a starting point for next year. And so as a percentage of sales, we can see that will fall significantly, particularly as our revenues increase. And that's an important thing to consider. So when we come down to the EBITDA line of 6.4, the underlying call-out number of 0.2 minus is really the headline number of 6.4 less the Chemist Warehouse charge of 6.2. We haven't called out in the presentation the effect of doubtful debts and the additional slob. I think it's better to explain those to users, but there is some additional EBITDA that we could potentially look at as a starting point for the business if we factored those in. Moving below those lines, we, during the course of the year, incurred some acquisition-related costs of $3.4 million. Our share of net loss of associates is $700,000, and we are looking at aspects of those associates that are underperforming in terms of a strategic review, and it's important to recognise that's an action underway. The depreciation and amortisation number has increased significantly year over year. That has partly been due to the additional lease depreciation, the AASB 16 effect of moving to the new premises at Clayton, as well as some additional CapEx. And then the amortisation charge has increased by $4.6 million, largely due to the amortisation of customer lists, which are acquisition related, as well as the amortisation of ERP and website development. the number of 13.6 is likely to be slightly higher next year, but not by a material amount, and we can talk to that separately. The interest line is a reflection of the elevated levels of debt that the business is carrying, and we can talk further about that, but that's purely a reflection of that. Tax is $15.4 million benefit. Now, that is partly a reclassification of an R&D grant, which previously was shown above the line as part of other income. It should appropriately be classified as a tax benefit. We do undertake quite a degree of R&D, and we get government support for that. We also were able to finalise our tax workings and determine that we were entitled to some temporary full expensing deductions for the investment in the manufacturing plant at Clayton. That combined with the loss carryback rules, we believe we're entitled to a further $8.3 million tax receivable or tax gain as a result of that. And those two charges being the R&D and the tax benefit or the tax receivable of 8.3 represents the bulk of that $15.4 million tax benefit. We do have a significant statutory NPAT loss of 335.6, which reflects largely the impairment losses and some of the other one-offs we spoke about. However, our underlying NPAT is minus 2.7, and there is a schedule later on in the presentation which speaks to that, which I won't go through at this moment, and resulting in an earnings per share loss of 214.2 cents. I might move to the next slide and talk about the balance sheet. So the balance sheet comprises, we've segmented the balance sheet into how we prefer to manage the business. And so what we see is a net working capital line consisting of trade and other receivables, inventories and trade payables. And you can see that the inventory line year over year is a significant increase of $19 million. Now some of that is due to acquisitions of 8. But we do think that there has been an $11 million year over year increase just through the ordinary course of operations. We believe that we're targeting a $15 million reduction in that inventory line. However, that will take time for us to deliver that, but that's certainly something that is high on our initiative list. As we progress down the page, you'll notice a significant reduction in the intangibles line, reflecting the impairment charge that we've incurred. I'll talk to that in the following slide. But we also see a significant increase in both the right of use lease assets and the plant and equipment, reflecting the new lease at Clayton for the property, and that's a 15-year lease that we've entered into, as well as the CapEx that's been undertaken to improve our operational capabilities here. And then we spoke earlier about the tax receivable of 8.5. That was largely the $8.3 million that we believe we will get back from the Australian Tax Office. So that sort of covers off on the asset side. I do want to focus a little bit on the liability side as well, and you'll see an increase in the lease liability, which is the Clayton lease liability we spoke of. The increase in the deferred tax liabilities and the tax payable line represents some recognition of acquisition timing differences, as well as a tax payable within one of our subsidiaries. The one I really want to call out is the put option. Now, this was a put option liability that we recorded upon the acquisition of the GoTo business, and this represents the 49% equity holders' ability to put the business back to us, in effect. When we recognised that initially, that was $89.2 million. And as we've all things that are subject to a third-party valuation, valuation of that put option liability backed by third-party valuers has reduced by $30 million to $59.2. Now, that is it doesn't go through the P&L. That's the charge against the, if you like, the equity or reserve balance, but that's an important call-out for us. The other important call-out is our net debt figure at 30 June. So there's two ways of looking at net debt. One is the AASB 16 inclusive amount, which is $107 million. But a lot of people are used to looking at the balance excluding the lease liabilities. And so our pre-AASB 16 net debt is $64.3. Now, we do want to call out that our net debt has been impacted by not only negative operating cash flow, which we'll talk to in a minute, but we've incurred additional costs or additional expenditure in CapEx, obviously the lease liabilities, and then acquisition-related liabilities as well. So I'll move now to the non-cash impairment charges. So I touched upon our business performance at the revenue line earlier. Now, what we found in our review of impairment was that every single acquisition or every single good cash-generating unit was underperforming against the plans, and it had been doing so well for the bulk of the year. And so that underperformance, when you undertake these valuations, that underperformance naturally places a lot of pressure on the value and use models. And that is the key driver behind this impairment charge, the continued underperformance in the revenue lines against the plan. The other factor, which is not as significant but also relevant, is that with the higher interest rate environment, that did increase our weighted average cost of capital discount rates, which also placed downward pressure on the valuations. Of the $322 million, we can see that the largest portion of that impairment relates to our US business, which we'll talk to separately. That is a business that we would love to see more growth come from, but that's a work in progress. The next largest being the Australian international business, which includes the GoTo acquisition. We do want to call out that of the $128 million, approximately $43 million relates to the GoTo acquisition, which leaves about $85 million for the sort of non-GoTo part of the Australian business. So that $43 million is also consistent with the downward pressure or downward valuation of the put option liability, and effectively they're not quite two sides of the same coin, but they're similar directionally. It is a large number, but at the end of the day, this impairment effectively reflected the share price that we were trading upon before our suspension. So probably not likely to be a surprise for the market, but it is a disappointing number nonetheless. Moving to the cash flow. Again, this cash flow format reflects our internal preference in terms of how we wanted to manage the business, and it starts off with an EBITDA number of 6.4 and changes in working capital and comes down to an operating cash flow line. But in essence, the EBITDA line is offset by the non-cash Chemist Warehouse cash a charge of 6.2, so that's almost a break-even EBITDA. The real drivers of the working capital deterioration is the net working capital movement, and you can see the $11 million stock line there. Now, we think that we're targeting a $15 million turnaround at the working capital line into FY23, and as we expect a big delta on this year's performance. The acquisition-related payments, we don't expect that to recur. Interest, it is what it is. It's a reflection of our higher debt levels, and that may change depending on where the debt lands. But of the 9.6 of tax, we expect that to be a positive 8 into FY23, less about 2.6 of some subsidiary tax payments. So there's some very positive trends emerging or anticipated cash inflows that we expect from the cash flow line into FY23, which will reverse this number. For the 22.2, I think we've covered. It's also worth noting that we've spent $30 million of CapEx in both the Clayton facility as well as ERP costs. We have incurred some further costs that were committed to in June, and so there will be some additional CapEx, but nowhere near the $30 million for the next fiscal year. And I think with that, I'm going to hand that back over to Roy.
Thanks so much, Bill, for a really comprehensive overview of the financials. Now moving to segment performance on slide 11. As Bill mentioned through the impairment piece, BetaWorks recognises three CGUs, being Australia International, which includes GoTo, a digital segment in the Americas, and all the revenues I'll talk through on a statutory basis. I will go through by brand level mix, and those brands relate to the global brand business as opposed to this segment here. Revenues from the Australia International segment did increase year on year to 89.5. Those segments comprise sales generated through ANZ, Southeast Asia, Europe, Middle East, Africa, and other select international markets. However, within that, Seekin was down 14.7% on prior year, with sales impacted by the decision to forego the investment buy in the fourth quarter. COVID impacts in the first half in sales channels across Australia. I think we all remember first quarter of last year with lockdowns, and also impacted not just within Australia, but Asia and European markets. While our Seekin sales performance was strong in Woolworths, offsetting the pharmacy channel declines, Woolworths does sell as a growing proportion of personal wash category sales, which do come at a lower gross margin, so we've got to be cognizant of that and balance that with promotional activity, etc. Although revenues were impacted, we did secure new distribution gains, both in re-ranging and NPD, across many of our existing retail partners in Australia, as well as gains internationally with retailers like AS Watson, Amazon, and new retail partners like Douglas and Look Fantastic. So there's very encouraging signs there. The performance of the Americas segment did decline 4.2% to $76.8 million, and those sales include sales generating Canada, the US, and into South America. While Mineral Fusions encouragingly were up 17.6% on prior year, Andalou sales, as flagged earlier, were impacted by the manufacturing transfer to Clayton and moving away from the US-based co-manufacturers and ensuring that we didn't have a disrupted supply chain during that period and the removal of a number of promotions during that time to make sure that we have a more stable business as we transitioned, but it made that an important transition. We secured new distribution gains in food, drug and mass channel, which is an important part of the US strategy to move outside of the natural channel, and retail partners including JCPenney, Target and Nordstrom throughout the year. Performance of the digital segment, which comprises the two e-com platforms being Flora and Fauna and Nourish Life, increased with the full 12-month contribution of Flora and Fauna, which wasn't in the prior period. But sales were impacted on both platforms by the macro digital disruption in a post-COVID world as people move back in towards bricks and mortar, as well as customer acquisition costs increasing upwards of 50 to 60% through FY22. We were also faced with significantly reduced promotional activity due to some stock shortages from key suppliers during the second half and the temporary relocation disruption as we moved both warehouses, one from Dandenong and one from New South Wales, into our Clayton facility. The strategic review we announced on May 22 is progressing, and we'll further update on this later on. Now diving into the brand performance, moving first to Seekin. $71.5 million total Seekin revenue for FY22 represents a decline of 14.9%. It's important to remember this revenue result is statutory, so it includes the Chemist Warehouse cost of equity partnership of 6.2 in FY22. Which we don't expect to repeat to that level in FY23, it'll be a much lower number. But on an underlying basis, excluding that, Seekin sales is down 7%. The biggest impact to that revenue and margin was the decision to cancel domestic investment buys in the June quarter of circa $20 million. Gross margin was also impacted in the range of 56 to 60, and we know that's lower than Seekin normally delivers. But due to the cancellation of those investment buys, which come at a high gross margin, and as a result of growth of lower margin categories such as personal wash and Woolworths, it's a gross margin mix we don't expect to continue, and we do expect it to recover strongly into FY23, but it was impacted with those key decisions in FY22. While revenues did decline, scan out data for both the full 12 months showed scan performance of plus 12%, and for the more recent six-month period ending June, showed Seekin was growing value share by 19%. This in-market consumption data supports our view that our brand market share is healthy and will recover over time as inventory across our wholesale and retail channels is normalising in a post-COVID lockdown environment. This view is supported by a 13% year-on-year increase in points of distribution. While Seekin in particular was impacted by the decision to cancel investment buyers, we're focused on consistent, sustainable sales and protecting those future profit and margins for the group. Now turning over to Andalou. Andalou generated $38.3 million in revenues for FY22, which was a decline of 19%. Performance and margin was adversely affected by the manufacturing transfer of approximately 80% of Andalou SKUs to Clayton and the subsequent reduction in promotional activity as we run down the older inventory that's based in the US from co-manufacturers and the transition being the primary focus. The result was also affected by a slower return to the natural channel for traffic in the US where the bulk of our Andalou sales are generated through retailers such as Whole Foods and Sprouts. While we see increasing competition in skincare in the US natural channel, Andalou Scan, the brand remains the number one in the combined face and skin categories. Outside the US, Andalou's second biggest market, South Korea, did suffer heavily through COVID-19 lockdowns more recently in second half 22. During the period, conversely, we did increase points of distribution by 25% to nearly 500,000. Turning over now to our other US-based brand, being Mineral Fusion. Our Mineral Fusion brand did have a standout performance with revenue of $30.9 million, representing year-on-year revenue growth of 17.5%. Importantly, fourth quarter sales for the brand increased 66% versus that prior quarter, and that growth has continued to accelerate. Mineral Fusion market share has outperformed with 19% growth compared to a 10% growth in the broader US natural channel cosmetics category. So while cosmetics are rebounding post-COVID, Mineral Fusion is outperforming in that space. FY22 result was supported by a successful brand packaging relaunch as we moved from the brown packaging into the rose gold packaging, new display stands, new product development, and a more focused brand position. Points of distribution increased 11% to 453,000. We're really excited about what Mineral Fusion's growth can do now, particularly as we're rolling the brand out across JCPenney, which I'll talk about in more detail later, and other customers in the US. Turning over now to GoTo. GoTo for the nine-month period of our partnership reported revenues of $25.2 million versus the corresponding nine-month period, which was $26.7, representing a revenue decline of 5.6%. Pleasingly, GoTo second-half revenue result of 15.8 was impacted by the lag effect of retail lockdowns along the eastern seaboard, again with Mecca being closed in that first quarter, as well as Omicron variant, which was present, and specifically for GoTo in Mecca, the challenges around in-store testing were still present through that period. Looking at second half 22, the sales did increase 10% on that prior half, successfully supported by NPD launches, as well as the resumption of in-store event participation with Zoe, the return to more normalised shopping, removal of face masks, being able to do testing and makeup trials, et cetera, continued, and we've seen good sales generation post that. Despite that revenue performance, we've seen good growth across a range of core customer metrics during the 12 months. It's worthwhile reminding everyone that nearly 75% of revenue on GoTo occurs on the GoTo.com website. The GoTo gang loyalty base increased 67%, current lifetime value of $420, which is nearly 200% higher than regular customer lifetime value of $300. And this is a key driver of customer retention for GoTo, where 75% of those the revenues are generated. Website increased 11%, conversion also increased by 7%. Repurchase rate was strong, and it's where the percentage of customers that have placed multiple orders was 48%, again a further increase. Despite the decline during that nine-month performance period, we believe the three-year strategy in place can unlock its true global potential, and I'll discuss further in the outlook. Turning over now to our e-commerce brands. As covered on the segment performance overview, the disappointing result for both was a combination of some internal challenges and macro headwinds. Flora and Fauna delivered revenues of $15.2 million, or an 8% decline. Nourish Life delivered revenues of $16.8 million, 33% decline. both gross margin ranges declined slightly at around 29 to 32%. For flora and fauna, the result was impacted by out of stocks and a reduction in inventory as we prepared for the relocation of the warehouse and ran less promotions than prior year. For Nourish Life, that temporary disruptive impact of consolidating the warehouse from Dandenong to Clayton during the fourth quarter, which also resulted in a short non-fulfillment period. Both platforms, as all e-commerce platforms have had through post-COVID, been impacted by the macro challenges of rising customer acquisition with costs up above 50% on the same time last year and an increasingly competitive online landscape. I will update on the strategic review process shortly. Turning now through to FY23 outlook and our strategic priorities. At our Investor Day, we laid out the strategic plan for FY23 through 25, revolving around five key priorities, and those are growing revenue, so through brand distribution activation in key regions and channels, unlocking margins by brand through price, procurement and further efficiencies, managing our cost base through $10 million in cost out, sustainable earnings supported by manufacturing capacity, and most importantly, financial discipline to further reduce net debt, normalise our inventory and our working capital. We've made significant early progress on these priorities despite being heavily distracted through this half. Over 1.7 million total points of distribution, or plus 21% versus the prior period, including gains in JCPenney, while also exiting at the same time non-core markets. Although distribution points aren't linear with revenue gains, distribution gains are expected to translate into revenue performance over time. Implementation of trade spend and marketing return on investment software with the tool Blue Shift we implemented to support more targeted spending and ensure that our return on investment is paying back effectively. On our margins, we executed price increases for our core brands from first half 23 to ensure margin protection, particularly in a high inflation period on import costs. We expect the benefits of the new manufacturing facility and the implementation of AutoStore to support further efficiencies later in FY23 once inventory normalises. In managing the cost base, we did increase our cost out initiative from $5 million to $10 million, which is broadly implemented with a little bit more to go. Inventory reductions have continued with $5 million wound back from that April inventory peak and a target of a further $15 million through FY23. And to create more sustainable earnings, our organisation restructure will further support our strategic priorities and improve financial reporting processes, but more importantly, focus. At the same time, we're focused on deleveraging the business over the long run. During fourth quarter, as mentioned earlier, we completed a capital raise to reduce debt, which led to the permanent retirement of $10 million in net debt at the end of FY22. We're progressing with that strategic review of non-core assets to ensure we can reach our longer-term goals. And I'll now hand over to Bill to talk through some of those.
Yeah, thanks, Rory. So I think this is a really interesting part of the presentation because where we talk about a business that's currently generating group margin of 53% and we've got a target of 62 to 64, I think we've already demonstrated in the conversation earlier that a climb from 53 to 58 is already achieved when we take out those one-off costs we spoke of. We haven't yet seen the benefit of the uplift or the ramp up in the production at Clayton. It's starting to occur, but a lot of that is sitting in inventory. So as we ramp up production and we start to sell through that product out of Clayton, there's another 300 basis points, which takes us from the 58 to the low 60s. And the remainder is achieved through a sales mix issue that we're going for at the moment, and that sales mix is largely, we talked about the downturn in some of our key brands, but it's largely due to the elevated inventory positions within our customer base, which we'll talk to later on. That's affected our higher margin products more than some of our lower margin products, and that mix should come through. And so we're actually feeling really excited about the gross margin target. Now, we also spoke about OPEX and some of the one-offs affecting our OPEX line. If we take our the $10 million of people savings and we add back the effect of doubtful debts and the elevated audit fee, there's about $14.5 million of cost savings there. Now, applying it against our costs might get us to the 40% of OPEX to sales target, but we are targeting a headline revenue line of $230 million potentially this year. And with those savings on an annualised basis, that gets us to an OPEX to 43% against the revenue line. And so again, that is that 40% target is quite achievable as we continue the growth path into next year. We think that once we normalise working capital, the cash conversion rate of 70% is actually very achievable, and that end result will give us leave us with a business with a very, very healthy EBITDA margin and net debt levels that are far more commensurate with its size and risk. So I think these longer term goals are very achievable, and the actions that we've put in place are definitely the way to move forward. So I think we might move to the next slide. And with these initiatives, we've covered these off, and we're just doing a further deep dive into them. So the cost controls that we've got in place, they're supported by actions that we've already achieved or already implemented of $10 million on the operating line. As mentioned, there's some one-off costs where we think we can do a bit more than that, but I think we'll run with the $10 million for conservatism. I think, moreover, there is an increased level of discipline in our approach to running the business. And it starts off in the basics with how we look at our trade spend, the management of each individual account, the returns that we expect from each of the co-op and other marketing and trade spend that we undertake. There needs to be an appropriate return on investment. And that's the sort of discipline that we're trying to outlay into the business and emphasise. It's not rocket science, but it is something that we've got to get better at doing. And that sort of mindset, when we apply it to inventory and our integrated business planning, we'll flow through to a inventory level that is commensurate with the size of organisation. That $15 million, it should be said that we're sitting on of excess inventory, it's not necessarily because we were mismanaging inventory. It was just a reflection of the factors that we had to go through. And those factors involved moving a significant piece of plant equipment from Dandenong into Clayton, building that up significantly. And so whenever you move manufacturing operations, you have to have safety stock, and that's what we did. We did the right thing. We built up safety stock. The other thing that occurred, unfortunately, is that when that move occurred, there was a general appetite to hold more stock everywhere because of supply chain issues affecting not only Australia but moreover globally. And what we've seen is an easing of those supply chain issues. They're still there in some geographies, but they're nowhere near as severe. And so we ourselves don't need to be holding as much stock, but then we've also found that our customers' appetite for holding extra stock has also diminished. So that excess inventory holding will take a little bit of time to get through, but it's something that we're working on actively as we speak. In terms of the strategic review, we are looking at a number of the parts of the business that are underperforming. We are working with external advisors. We've already announced the sale of the USPA business. It's a relatively small divestment, and we're divesting our Nourish Ventures businesses. But it's certainly a live conversation that we're having internally. With that, I'll hand over to Rory.
Thanks, Beryl. Moving into brand strategy, and I'm going to focus on our four core brands, our four high-margin brands, and talk through the global strategy, the domestic strategy, and product strategy for each. So moving to Sukin. For Sukin, in line with our strategic plan, we are making investment choices around a tighter group of priority markets rather than trying to spread ourselves and try to do too many things not very well. We're focusing those resources on the best strategies to drive growth in higher return regions, markets and customers. So from a global perspective, we're focusing on increasing distribution in food, drug and mass across the Americas, and with JCPenney launch, a major win and opportunity, not just for Sukin, but all, for all three brands. Where Sukin really thrives as well as in supermarkets, beauty and e-commerce, and we'll focus on that expansion through Europe and Asia. Within domestic, we have a big focus, first and foremost, to get consistent, sustainable order and replenishment cycles. We still have inventory, excess inventory in half one that we are continuing to reduce with our customer partners who don't want to hold the level of inventory they held during the COVID times. Continue strong distribution gains with our largest customers in Woolworths, Coles, Chemist Warehouse, as well as direct-to-consumer growth. And we're doing that through the next point around product strategy, new product innovation across core categories of skin, personal wash and hair. And you can see some of that to the right. Leveraging local retailer support, co-investments, such as Teen Skin and Skin Relief products, which were launched exclusive to Chemist Warehouse. Macroeconomic pressures, including inflation, are top of mind for consumers, but we think in value brands like Sukin in mass channels carry more appeal. Turning over to Handler and Mineral Fusion. For these predominantly US-based brands, focus for the Handler and Mineral Fusion's further penetration of food, drug and mass. Obviously, these brands are super successful and hold market-leading positions in the natural channel with Whole Foods and Sprouts. But we want to take these brands into the more mainstream where the biggest opportunities lie, the first of that being a department store chain, JCPenney. As well as opportunities outside Americas, we want to, once we've complete the regulatory compliance for Europe, we'll be able to go into more markets across Australia, Europe and Asia. Globally, we continue to be focused on the second biggest market in South Korea, as well as the growth we're getting in the Australian business. For the USA, the core focus is on penetrating food, drug and mass, and the rollout of JCPenney, which we commenced in the last 6 weeks of FY22. And we're rolling into about 75 stores per month, which will generate not just for Mineral Fusion, but for Mineral Fusion, Andaloo and Sukin, over 150,000 new distribution points for the half. And early signs, and particularly given our placement in those stores, we're having some great early wins. And of course, we don't want to neglect our past. So we want to maintain growth in the natural channels, as well as digital, where we do have a high proportion of our sales sold in the US online than we do in other markets. In terms of product strategy, we're focusing on leveraging the Andaloo brand packaging refresh, which is happening at the moment, which will roll out in FY24, and the Mineral Fusion new packaging change, which I mentioned earlier, that happened during FY22 and has begun rolling out through FY23. Innovative NPD, focused on the consumer always, expanding core ranges, particularly focused on skin and nail. The global pricing strategy, supported by local retailer marketing and co-investment. And great success with the continued brand ambassador campaigns to grow brand awareness outside of natural and digital. Turning over to GoTo. GoTo's outlook is supported by major retail partner wins that are continuing to roll out into FY23. Globally, GoTo is already in discussions and has secured multiple wins. We've supported that with product compliance reviews completed for Europe, the UK and Canada. In Europe, we can confirm the launch of GoTo with premium retailer Douglas in the second half of this year. This launch will take place in 6 countries, including Germany, the Netherlands and Spain. With the success of GoTo rolling out in the Australian mass market, we're now also reviewing further international opportunities for that range. Domestically, within Australia, GoTo has been focused on executing GoTo's mass market strategy, confirming the launch of GoTo into 900 Coles stores, 175 Woolworths stores, also in 176 Big W stores, and just under 500 Priceline stores in second half 23. So fantastic distribution gains for the GoTo range. The Mecca partnership, which continues to provide exclusive, incredible touch point for the brand in Australia, with it now the ability in a post-COVID world to activate eventing and tactical in-store promotions. The new advertising campaign, as you can see a snippet off to the right, launched in August. It's really exciting. It's the first above-the-line campaign to really broaden awareness and really increase the brand awareness of GoTo around Australia. The campaign includes a mix of outdoor, online video and socials. The primary goal of the campaign is to increase awareness and acquire new customers while maintaining customer acquisitions to costs to FY22. The higher brand awareness you have, the lower your customer acquisition costs. In terms of product strategy, GoTo has a strong pipeline, particularly focused around SPF technology, introducing new advanced filters, sensory experiences, and a strong sustainability focus. August also saw the successful first launch for GoTo's SPF Protect pillar with Nifty 50, which delivered $1.3 million in its first week, highlighting the strength that new news and NPD can deliver. GoTo will also launch a fragrance-free version for sensitive skin in second half of 23, which is particularly important for mothers and their babies. Now moving out to Outlook. As mentioned in the start of the presentation, we expect revenue in the range of $205 to $230 million with EBITDA in the range of $25 to $30. Half one will operate at a loss while we continue to undertake restructuring and incur trade spend and other promotional costs as customer held inventory reduces to more normalised levels. One-off of normal restructuring of Isa costs are also impacting our profitability. Short-term liquidity constraints have been affecting our revenues. However, they are now supported by expanded debt facility, which we also announced. Board renewal continues with the appointment of Mr. Stephen Fisher as new chair and independent non-executive director. As we reduce that inventory in our customers, the lower than anticipated revenues have impacted our working capital, have been the key driver of those trading losses. As a result, our short-term debt levels have increased significantly. The risks and sensitivities around that revised guidance include completing that group-wide org structure by third quarter 23 with strict financial discipline and inventory rundown continuing as a priority, completing long-term debt restructure in half 2023, normalising that customer held inventory levels to be more aligned with consumer demand to provide more sustainable and predictable earnings, which we expect to come through in half 2023, and of course managing closely any other macroeconomic factors that are impacting our industry and taking appropriate action. Now, with that being our last slide, and before I do get to questions, I did want to reiterate my acknowledgement and apology for our extended suspension as we address key issues regarding revenue restatement and significant impairment, amongst other matters. The challenging period we have just come through has been frustrating for all, and the team and I are looking forward to getting on now with running the business and continuing the heavy lifting still required to ensure that it's one that our shareholders are proud of again. I'll now open the floor for questions.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Sam Teeger from Citi. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Rory. Long time no speak.
Thanks, Sam.
Given profitability is lower than expected, how are you thinking about getting biggest bang for buck in terms of global marketing? Why aren't you better off just focusing solely on the US to optimise your marketing scale instead of also pursuing all these other international markets at the same time?
Yeah, Sam, really good question. The heavy focus is absolutely on the US. I would say for GoTo, the focus on Douglas in Europe is a key focus. But we are, constraining the markets we do participate in. We have exited a number of markets in FY22 and at the start of FY23. And you're right, the core markets for our business is Australia and the US. And now we have a strong retail partnership in Europe to support with GoTo. Concentrating those marketing efforts are important. The bigger focus is not just the amount of dollars spent and where we spend it, but, you mentioned biggest bang for your buck. That Blue Shift tool we've implemented, measuring marketing ROIs and ensuring we get the biggest bang for the bucks is critical. And also, even though we expect to have a slight reduction in our marketing spend this year, we will be spending more on consumer-facing marketing spend. In prior years, a lot of marketing spend has been, gobbled up by projects and, research projects and a number of non-consumer-facing efforts, and we want to make sure that every dollar of marketing we spend not just has a great ROI, but it's getting to as many eyeballs as possible and increasing overall brand awareness. So US will be a strong focus for the business, but we also have to maintain our brand in Australia predominantly and support GoTo through Europe.
Understand. And just in terms of the guidance range and the assumptions behind that, what are you factoring in regards to a weakening global consumer?
Yeah, so we've made some assumptions, you're right, in terms of the trends we're seeing, and it's probably a different experience we're seeing from a scanner perspective in Australia than we're seeing in the US, so versus our sales out, and I'll talk about our customer inventory levels coming down predominantly in Australia. So we see Sukin responding quite well in the channels it's mainly exposed to, being supermarkets and discounters are in like Chemist Warehouse or discount department stores like Target and Kmart. So we are in, I suppose, the right place with a value brand that offers good value to consumers. So I think we are broadly protected there, but cognizant of it. In a market like the US, where we have a fair bit of exposure to a channel like the natural channel, so Whole Foods and Sprouts, which we know are more expensive retailers, and we are seeing some foot traffic falls, we have factored those short-term declines into our revenue forecasts. And you know, the job to do in the US is to get our brands into more places in food, drug and mass, and that's where something like Sukin works really well in a supermarket environment. So we have factored that in, but we have made some assumptions around our revenue, some of those revenue declines, but particularly in the US.
All right. Thanks, Rory. Maybe if I can ask a question for Stephen. Can you please talk us through how you're planning to design incentives for the management team to ensure this end-of-period investment buying doesn't continue?
Be rest assured that it won't continue. It stopped, and I think that the rigor that's been put in and the focus that's been on it is now well established, and we will come up with a new scheme. It's day one, but it won't happen again, I can assure you.
All right, cool. And just last question, if I may, just if you guys can step us through the thinking about the ability of the business to fund that go-to option in 2024?
I mean, with our cash flow forecasting, I mean, we talked earlier about the turnaround in working capital and the increased EBITDA. I mean, those two initiatives just on their own is about a $40 to $45 million additional level of cash flow coming out, generated from the business. And so if all we did was to generate that sort of EBITDA for the next 2 years, that would just about get us there to have the cash to pay down that money. Now, clearly, we've got other initiatives on the horizon in terms of we'd like to outperform that EBITDA number and improve upon things, but that sort of trajectory is a positive one and could get us there absent other initiatives.
All right. Thanks, guys. All the best.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Philip Pepe from Shaw and Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the question. Just on current trading conditions, I mean, all the data and the result was ending 30 June, 30 July. We're obviously 25 weeks into your financial year. So how are you tracking in actual terms for 1H23? What's the first half, second half split likely to be? And what's your actual current level of debt? Because you said it's gone up, but I haven't been able to find the actual dollar amount anywhere. So what's the balance sheet look like as at 19 December?
Yeah, so I'll talk to some of the trading numbers. There is a disconnect, and we have flagged that there is a half one will be a loss. We won't flag the quantum of the loss, but in terms of the impacts have predominantly happened in the first quarter, as we fix a number of initiatives in the business, and removing this customer held inventory, post a cancellation of investment buyers is an important step. It's a painful step, but it's an important step. And we're incurring trade spend through that period. So while we're reducing revenues, and it's in excess of $10 million in the half of customer-held inventory, so this is inventory that has been sold prior that they'd purchased, but we want to run it down to more sustainable levels in a post-COVID world. We're also incurring trade spend through that period. So while we run promotions, we're not getting any sales for them. We're just incurring trade spend. And so that we're wearing that pain through this half, and getting that revenue, the inventory down in our customers is a critical step to having more sustainable earnings going forward. And we see that reverse out quickly in the second half. We've got to move away from the famine and feast approach to running the business, having investment buyers, generating investments, generating revenue and EBITDA, through investment buyers at a couple of months of the year, and the associated impact that has on our working capital through the year and also cash receipts. And so we're living that sort of painful period now. When I think about scan performance, on the back of price increases, improvements, and I'll specifically talk to Australia First, with Sukin, for example, moving to EDLP on our larger pack sizes to improve margin, but also sales performance, those initiatives are gaining traction, so consumption is performing well. And where we're down slightly is because we've removed frequency of a couple of 50% off promotions, and we've done that because we have been in a bit of a short-term liquidity challenge period, and we have removed some promotions to protect stock. But putting those back in the second half will help improve things. And as Viral mentioned, those one-off abnormal costs relating to advisor costs, restructuring costs, et cetera, really impacted that first half. With that, I might hand over to you to talk about the other question on net debt.
Okay, so our net debt position, we expect, we've spoken about our peak debt of $95 million. That's where we expect the net debt to peak at. Now, this close to the half year, that's likely to be just after the half year just because of the intra-month cash flows. But I think it's important to focus on that number as opposed to the reported number to put a proper focus on things.
Did that cover everything, last Philip?
Yes, I mean, sort of. I'll do the maths and work out the rest. But if I can ask a follow-up question. In terms of changing from, as you said, promotion on 2 months in a year, you've got some pretty powerful customers. One of them, my understanding, that's how they do their business across the board. So what's been their reaction to your changing strategy? Have they, for example, sent any stock back? Have they reduced future spending, future orders? Are they accepting that and continuing on, or are they switching out your products for other products in some cases?
So can I just ask, was that reduce of promotions or reduction in the investment buyers?
So the removal of the investment buyers, how have your customers responded to that?
I think I've said this previously, our customers are happy with the removal of investment buyers. It's something that was, you know, I guess rife in the industry for a long period of time, and something that B2X has relied too heavily upon. And, you know, I want to make sure our commercial teams are having conversations with customers about consumer pull through, you know, how we sell more products, run better promotions, run better in-store marketing campaigns to get sales going through the checkouts as opposed to into the distribution centres. And that's what we've probably done too much of in the past. So we're faced into that. That reset is, you know, if we want to run the business for the short term, we'll just keep doing investment buys. If we want to make sure we're getting sustainable earnings over the medium long term and building a better business where we can invest more in our brands, we've got to walk away from investment buys. It's unnecessary noise, both for ourselves but for our customers as well. You know, I think all customers are reevaluating their total inventory holdings now. You know, price increases in inventory has put the value of inventory up for holding the same amount of stock. Interest rates have gone up, so the carrying cost of that inventory has increased. It's the right thing to do, Phil, but it's painful. You know, the actions and things we're going through right now is by moving away from things that were less sustainable and moving towards a more sustainable selling process. So our conversations with our customers are now more proactive, they're more positive, they're noisy. Like, you know, we've caused a bit of frustration to our key customers with the changes we've made, but we're through all of that now. Cycling this December, so this December, you know, last year there was an investment buy put into the market, we're not doing them this year. So, you know, our December results impacted us, you know, versus year ago on that, and we'll make sure we explain that fully when we come out with the half results. But it's, you know, it's a new way of running the business. But I think, you know, the actions we've taken and getting through this is probably one, probably more respect with the customers, if anything.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Apoorv Sehgal from UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, AP.
Hey, morning, Rory and Viral. Maybe just a simple question to start off with, if you're right. Just on slides 27 and 28, could you just talk through just the components of the restatement, like it's the bill and hold, the sale or return transaction? Just explain sort of in layman terms sort of what that means, what you sort of uncovered in the audit process and just the length of time it took?
Yeah, look, it was a long audit. So when I joined, that process was still going, albeit the work had been done. Look, fundamentally, you know, if we look at the 30 June number, it was an issue around, it wasn't just the investment buy, there were also issues around certain customers having ERP issues, and so the business tried to react by assisting the situation by putting together a what effectively became a bill and hold transaction. And that bill and hold, the requirements under IFRS for bill and hold transactions are pretty strict. And, you know, you've got to have the product sitting in a separate part of the warehouse. You've got to have it documented. You can't be capable of selling it elsewhere. And so the failure of the revenue recognition standard was, you know, that was a big part of the story, was that that bill and hold requirement was just not met. Now, that was not done with any ill intention. It was just a reaction to the customer's own need for inventory, because the distribution partner were having supply chain disruptions through ERP implementation issues. So no one's Robinson Crusoe in that sense. But in essence, the FY21 number was quite significant. It was $10.5 million of sales that were reversed. There was some associated trade spend accruals, and so all up $11 million of very high margin product. And that was the crux of it. There was some other, I guess, documentary type issues which I won't go into, but the bill and, you know, fundamentally it was all revenue recognition related. That had a flow on consequence to the restatement of debtors and stock, which is outlined in note 1.4, but also affected cash flows as well. And so the P&L had a complete revamp. The half year was a little different. So that was more around investment buy activity. And so the view from the auditors was that, you know, elements of that activity didn't satisfy the inventory recognition standard for similar reasons, but everything's quite unique as well. There was a much larger trade spend catch-up that was associated with this, and that was because we had to, not only do we have to allow for more trade spend, but we also had to, under a bill and hold scenario, allow for products to be returned. So there's a return element as well, or a returns provision. So different set of circumstances, but very related. And then we had a contract asset adjustment, which related to the how we were expensing the Chemist Warehouse contract asset. We were using an incorrect share price, and so that flowed through as well as another adjustment, surprising the half-year adjustment. And again, when that was flowed through to trade debtors and stock, the balance sheet was adjusted. But probably the thing to point out is that a lot of these adjustments at the half then effectively were corrected sort of more naturally. It just flowed through to the second half results, so that the full year number didn't require, obviously, you know, by definition doesn't require a restatement because it's already baked into the numbers. But there's a bit to digest, and hopefully that gives you some sense of what happens.
Yep. No, thanks for the detail, Beryl. Just on gearing then, into FY23, I think previously you were guiding to 1 to 1.5 times net debt EBITDA. Am I right in saying that given debt's pretty elevated short term, that sort of target maybe is more so like an FY24 type story now?
Yeah, correct, AP. Like we had a target of that sort of 1 to 1.5. We'd expect it to be still in that sort of above maybe 1.5 to 2 for the short term. But as Beryl mentioned, there's a lot of initiatives underway to generate cash, as well as the asset reviews we've talked about previously. But, you know, when we provided that, the original numbers, original guidance, you know, we were doing that not knowing we were going into a 4-month suspension, an extended audit, a complete distraction, and incurring some, you know, trading losses in the first half. So feel like we've, you know, one of the better term, we've lost those sort of 4 or 5 months. So it feels like the financial year sort of starts today, as opposed to, July 1. So you expect a bit of a timing lag on some of those initiatives around some of the ratios.
And presumably with the 15 mil inventory reduction, that's also kind of flowing into 24 most likely.
So 15, I think broadly we can execute in 23 because we already have that inventory and we're running it down. We've had a bit of a lag effectively on the customer held inventory that we've talked about. So that rundown's occurred, so we're selling less in the short term. But a lot of the inventory is being held in the US. So on Andalou and Mineral Fusion, as we've changed Mineral Fusion over, we've changed over the supply chain from US back to Australia. So there's a different inventory there. So of that 15, you're broadly going to see in rough numbers, $7.5 million reduction in the US, probably a $4 to $5 million reduction in the Australia business. And go to after we, so we've got elevated inventory and go to as we build for the Douglas launch in the fourth quarter. So that sort of roughly gets us to that sort of $15 million further reduction. So we're still comfortable, we've got enough initiatives on that, that the bulk of it's coming through in the second half.
Okay. And then if I can just ask about the FY23 revenue and EBITDA guidance. So if I compare it to the last guidance from a few months ago, I think revenue's, like, broadly speaking, 50 or so lower, EBITDA 20 mil or so lower. Just the delta there, is it purely just the weaker foot traffic, the weaker, weaker macro from a top line point of view that's driving that difference in the guidance?
It is different by brand, but the bit you talk to is predominantly what's driving the US performance. The main driver from when we provided the guidance previously in the APAC business is the inventory that's already held in our customers that we're running down further, and that's circa $10 to $12 million in revenue, just on that one element, and obviously associated EBIT that comes with sales when you're making strong gross margins. When you're not selling, obviously that reverses out. And then the e-com business, being our Nourish Life and Flora and Fauna business, has been challenged through some of the disruptions we've had. And e-commerce sales are being impacted. And that's evident not just on our Nourish Life and Flora and Fauna business, but across all of our businesses. We're obviously close to the end of the half. And that reduction has been based on current trends we're seeing. And expected trends. And we are being a little bit conservative as we're facing into some, inflation headwinds, et cetera. And I'm more concerned about that in the US than I am in Australia. But they're the things we're considering.
Mm-hmm. And just to double check, that FY23 guidance is including the share-based payments expense?
Yes. But it's significantly lower.
That share-based payment last year it's going to be nowhere near that this year. So it's that is a genuine anomaly last year, just simply because the share price is high.
Understood. One last question, if I may, please. Just on the put option liability, $59 million. Can you just remind me of the mechanics there? Like, my understanding is there's no earn-out, I think. So how does, like, the calculation of 59 actually work? And sort of come October 2024, is it as simple as GoTo can exercise a put option where you pay them in cash at whatever the value is? Or is, I think there's like a call option involved as well. How does that sort of part of it work?
Yeah, so broadly, I mean, the maximum and why we put the 59.2 is it's independently valued. It's revalued every 6 months. So we'll continue to do between now and September 2024. We'll do a few further revaluation exercises for our own purposes. But if and when the put options are put to us, and they can be put fully or partially by the different shareholders, if we can't agree a price, we'll do an independent valuation exercise, and that can happen in year 3, which is September 2024. The call option mechanic happens the year after. In terms of what we're focused on with GoTo, it's all about growth. We're excited about the Douglas launch in the Europe. As a retailer, they're significantly larger than Mecca. The team's really geared up for the biggest, first step into the outside of Australia that's done previously. So, we're focused on those elements of the GoTo business. But as a put option, we have the valuation done, it was reduced from 89 to 59. and that'll be continually evaluated every 6 months. There's no price floor that's been reported previously. There's no earn out. Hopefully showing this exercise again might remove some of that noise that's out there. But, you know, it'll always be done at its value at the time.
Okay. Thanks for your time, guys.
Thanks, AP.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Sarah Mann from Moelis Australia. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. Just a question from me around, I guess, the retail scan data, hoping you can provide us a little bit more colour. I mean, you've mentioned that, you know, consumption seems to be good. Can you give us any colour around, I guess, how the natural channel's performing in the first half of F23 and how you guys are going from a market share position as well?
So I'm assuming by natural, you're talking the US, because we don't really have the natural channel here. But the
sure,
channel
US or Australia, yeah.
Yeah, the channel is down a little bit in the US, and I mentioned that earlier with foot traffic for Whole Foods and Sprouts, and those more premium retailers are down. Our share, and I mentioned Andalou previously, was down significantly with cancelled promotions. We're now actually trading in line with the category growth across Whole Foods and Sprouts. So whereas during FY22, with those reduced promotions, we had been losing market share over the last, and I can't remember the ending period, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's the last 4 months. It might have been ending around October or mid-November. We were picking up share again as we reinstated some of those promotions and got some distribution gains. And with Mineral Fusion, we're outperforming the category. And that was true as of up to the end of June 30, but that's also continued. Now we're getting a bit of a bump because obviously post-COVID, colour cosmetics are improving, people are going back to work, et cetera, and more people are going back to bricks and mortar shopping, and colour cosmetics is getting a beneficiary, but we are outperforming the category. So we're really comfortable in that space, but the job to do is to get Andal and Mineral Fusion outside of the natural channel. In Australia, we don't have a natural channel as defined, but we know Super operates with a natural consumer. And across Coles, Woolworths, our main pharmacy customers, our total basket has been improving with the exception of skin. And as Bill flagged, our skincare was down in the first quarter of FY23, predominantly due to reduced promotional frequency versus that same quarter a year ago. The answer to that's not just putting more promotions back in. We're going to balance the promotions with the new strategy of promotions we're putting, which is EDLP on our bigger packs to improve profitability. But that's where we're really focused. So speaking in Australia, in a more recent trading period, if you add all customers and all categories together, we're doing okay. We're pretty much broadly growing in line with the category, overperforming in some channels, underperforming in others. But the job to do is to focus on more profitable skincare growth for the next 6 months.
I can also just add, I mean, we talked about the discipline that we're introducing on the trade spend and the ROI. That has to go hand in hand with a genuine reassessment on the promotional and marketing strategy, as well as just general trade promos. So that's underway, and that's yet to see the full sort of benefits come through. That'll be a key focus area for us.
Got it. And just to clarify for the comment, I guess, about Sukin in Australia, is it fair to say the category's growing, or is that kind of experiencing some softness in the first half as, I guess, the conditions become more challenging?
Do you mean the skincare category or all the categories you're operating
in? Yeah, skincare category. Yeah.
Now look, skin is performing well across the board. Our value is down because we've removed some promotions, and that's the reality of it. We'll reassess what we do there, but the skincare category is performing well across, which, you know, I don't take it as a negative. I take it as a positive because we know we can participate well in a growing category. And there's a lot of new brands that have entered the market over the last couple of years. You just have to walk into a retailer or a chemist warehouse who are, you know, famous for skincare and see all the brands that have been launched. Our job to do is to get some additional innovation happening, get the right level of promotions and in-store marketing happening. So I'm not deterred by where growing behind the category in skincare. I'm encouraged by it because we know some of the things we've done have been more self-inflicted because we've removed promotions, et cetera. So, you know, but we don't want to just go and put in 10 promotions just to buy market share.
Thank you. And then just with regards to, I guess, some of the excess inventory your customers or wholesalers were holding, in terms of, I guess, ordering patterns, have you seen that kind of, I know you flagged kind of the first quarter was impacted, but by the second quarter, have ordering patterns kind of returned to normal from those customers, or is that something that's, you know, kind of yet to play out and you won't really see the benefit of, well, you won't see that return to normal till kind of the third quarter?
Yeah, so we're seeing it in some of the customers that were holding less inventory. So more of the supermarket type retailers have normalised their inventory levels and we're getting back to the normal weekly replenishment cycles. But through, I guess, that wholesale channel where there was more inventory off the back of investment buyers and supply chain disruptions and COVID, et cetera, that's where we're seeing the inventory be more painful to reduce from a profit perspective. And we'd see that particular channel normalise in that sort of third quarter. You know, once that normalises, we get a big swing from a profitability perspective, which is, you know, again, that's the bulk of where we're incurring losses in the first quarter to date, because we're running promotions without sales. But it's important thing to do because, you know, once we're through that, once we're through December and we cycle out of the last investment buy that will ever be done in the business, and as Steve mentioned, it won't happen again, we just get back to normal trading performance going through, you know, month in, month out of normal revenue, gross margin, operating costs and earnings instead of the famine and feast approach. So we are going through a painful exercise in the short term to get there. But we'd expect, you know, in that third quarter, all customers' inventory to be replenished on a more more normalised level.
Got it. And then just a question on GoTo. So you flagged a lot of kind of expanded ranging for GoTo in the second half particularly, and clearly there have been some good kind of new product launches, et cetera. What was kind of the main driver, despite all those positive things, of kind of the second half, I guess, revenue decline versus the prior period? And then in terms of, I guess, new product launches in this current half, I mean, clearly you've got the sunscreen product. I mean, can you give us any colour around, I guess, how the NPD has continued beyond that really strong kind of first week of sales that you called out?
Yeah, so a bit to unpack there, Sarah. All the GoTo stuff is really launching in FY23. And GoTo has been a focus domestically because, as you're aware, the Mecca contract we have exclusivity for, they're our exclusive partner in Australia for skincare for the GoTo range. So we've had the opportunity to use relationships with those more mainstream retailers to get GoTo out into other markets in Australia, and now we're reviewing for the world. With GoTo, we can't go into other partners in Australia, so we've looked abroad, and the team have done a sensational job with the engagement with Douglas, a retailer that, if they had their way, would probably like us to go into all 2,000 plus of their stores from day one, but we're effectively going to 6 countries in around 500 stores to make sure that we launch appropriately. So that's more of the GoTo focus. You sort of touched on the performance of second half versus the second half prior. It was a little bit different in terms of NPD launched in that period versus NPD launched in that corresponding period, as well as it was only really in the fourth quarter of the second half the team were able to really get back to the, you know, the big events and the, you know, the training sessions with all the in-store beauty trainers, et cetera. So that only really happened in the fourth quarter. And in current trading, we're seeing Mecca perform exceptionally well. And the run rates both on e-com, Mecca's performance, particularly off the back of the advertising campaign the team has done, have really carried through. SPF in that first week was the biggest launch they've done. There's a number of other NPDs planned. And as you know, the excitement and the noise generated around NPD for GoTo is significant. But now we've cycled through the lockdowns from a year ago. We're getting to more normal behaviours. You know, touch wood, we don't go through that again. We'll get to a more consistent in-store testing, you know, product training, NPD launches, and the team have got some pretty exciting things planned for the next couple of years.
Got it. And then last question from me. You flagged the kind of incremental CapEx from the facility still expected in the current half. Can you tell us what that's around and kind of quantify it for us, please?
Yeah, a lot of it's actually in the commitments note, but it's in the vicinity of $6 million.
Got it. Thanks so much.
Nice.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Elijah Mayer from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, guys. Just a couple from me. Can we just circle back to just the revenue recognition for FY21? Can you sort of outline when the investment buy initiatives began and I guess who implemented? You say it was driven by sort of customer need, but maybe just who implemented it on the BWX side?
Yeah, so investment buys haven't just happened recently. They've been, I suppose, part of BWX and most consumer good businesses in certain customers for a long period of time. I used to do them as a Coles buyer 15, 20 years ago, so they're just part of the industry. So it wasn't, I wouldn't say it's a BWX initiative, but it's a lot of customers, wholesalers in particular, do it from an earnings perspective. And in the short term, they're attractive, but we don't want to run the business for the short term anymore. So we want to run the business for the medium to long term and make sure that the benefits of selling our products is more balanced between ourselves and customers. And when you do investment buys, it's more of a sometimes more of a one-way conversation. What we talked about in terms of, and you've got to cast your mind back, Elijah, to what life was like in, you know, April, May, 2021, feels like a lifetime ago, but investment buy supply chain disruptions were happening. We're one of the only Australian manufacturers in our categories of scale. Most of our competitors bring in products from overseas in the categories we play against. I'm pretty sure you remember what some of the aisles in supermarkets and pharmacies looked like back then. So there was there was an opportunity and a joint appetite from customers to source stock and make sure that they have stock available. And as Beryl talked about, the nature of an investment buy and a bill and hold transaction is exactly that, customer securing stock at a point in time and then being able to draw down on that stock in subsequent periods. The challenge we had was while we fulfilled most elements of the bill and hold transaction, there was a couple of elements where it fell over, and it's a high threshold from a transactional point of view that as we've gone back and looked into it, we didn't meet some elements of it. So from a planning perspective, because we do manufacture products, we have to plan these well in advance. Investment buys were planned to be done in June, and as mentioned, we walked away from them, but they were planned in the December previously, and they were planned the June before that. And to be able to do investment buys, you have to procure raw materials, you have to manufacture the stock, you have to sit it there, you have to ship it to customers and transact it. And that in itself generates a lot of noise, time, effort and energy. It throws a bit of a spanner in your operational business, cash flow perspective, all of that. I'd say to answer it more succinctly, it was a joint effort across businesses and retailers to conduct investment buys, but it was also a moment in time. And while I've always wanted to wind down investment buys, we decided to make sure we stopped them completely in June. Because I just don't think they're in the medium to long-term benefit of the business, and I think most retailers appreciate that as well.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to get to the bottom of where, maybe specifically in the criteria that it fell down in terms of revenue recognition, because in saying that it's been around for a long time and a lot of other retailers...
Yeah, I'll tackle that. So it wasn't... So Rory's absolutely right in terms of the environment around, pandemic and demand for products, et cetera. But there was an ERP issue that affected one of our channels. And so the end customer, if you like, decided to go direct to us and said, look, we can't get enough stock. Can you help? And that's the genesis of that sort of bill and hold transaction where in our attempt to be helpful to the customer who were struggling to get product out or were getting product but they were just scared that they weren't going to get enough, we ended up failing the revenue recognition standard for bill and hold transactions. And that's the fundamental issue, and that there are four criteria. We satisfied I think a couple of them, maybe even three, but there was one we didn't have the documentary evidence to satisfy the auditors, and we should have done better. I mean, that's just, we're not sort of blaming the accounting standard or anything like that, but we, you know, as a process, we failed, and as a consequence, we're having to record an accounting error and an adjustment to the prior period results.
And would that revenue restatement be spread across first half 21, second half 21, or is it sitting more in either of the halves?
Yeah, my understanding is that the second half, yeah.
It relates to transactions in June 21 specifically. So that's where the
value
is correct, conducted.
Because it just seems from the outside looking in there, because I mean, that was the time when you had guidance in the market for FY21 results, and it seems like there might have been some irregularities here that to try and reach those guidance numbers provided to the market. So that's why I'm just trying to get to the bottom of what exactly was the revenue recognition issue.
No, look, you're reading probably a little bit too much in Elijah, but you know, the reverse is true as well. Like, we don't run a passive organisation. Like, we have sales teams, and we have a number of things. We always try to work with our customers for promotional activity and additional things. So we're always doing that push. But in terms of the investment buy, it was while they've been conducted pretty much every half for 7+ years in VWX, specifically the one in June that they were referred to was, you know, a big investment buy, but portions of it, and it wasn't the whole amount, it was portions of the bill and hold transaction tripped over. And that's why the restatement was required.
And then maybe just on the additional debt facility being sort of expanded, I think the covenants are suspended until end of Jan 22. Can you sort of maybe give some details on what those covenants are, and I guess what happens if they're sort of breached, I guess, post-January, if those debt levels aren't reduced?
Look, I mean, it's January 23. I mean, those discussions are obviously live as we speak. We need to have further discussions to get that extended. That's probably all we can say at this stage.
Yeah, the focus has been on closing out the audit, having finalised results, and securing that, you know, expanded working capital facility. And now the conversation shifts to managing through new set of covenants and having them, you know, obviously extended to January 23, but we're able to probably focus, and when I say more focused on running the business, that includes things like that. So we've been heavily distracted with audit, full year results, and now we've got to get these elements finalised through Christmas and into the new year.
Yeah, so I guess because then it's not too far away, so next month or so you're just trying to come to a new understanding in terms of what the covenants are, or is there potential for more debt to be needed, or...?
Yeah, we'll keep everyone updated and informed, but we need to work through the covenants. In the presentation we talked to second half FY23, look at a more fulsome debt restructuring process, and we'll keep everyone updated as appropriate, Elijah.
And maybe just one final one, just in terms of GoTo and the liability that's sitting on the balance sheet. I understand it's been reduced, I guess, to 59 mil. The assumptions you've got in the report, sort of in terms of the valuation, have sort of annual growth, revenue growth of 9%. So is it right to say then if you sort of exceed those 9% growth targets within, or there are 9% growth numbers over the next sort of year or two with some of the initiatives you're putting in place, is it possible that that put option liability will increase?
It's a bit more complicated than that, because it comes down to how that 9% is generated. So there are some aggressive growth plans on the online part of GoTo. So there's a significant customer acquisition cost that comes with that growth. So it's not the only factor. It is a factor. What we've done is put in some realistic targets that we think are, and we're certainly seeing in terms of what they're achieving into this fiscal year, that's more or less what we're seeing. So, but it's not as straightforward as that. It comes down to the EBITDA impact and the profitability of the business. And as you grow an online business, there's always a lag effect between, you know, your customer acquisition cost and your ultimate sell-through sort of steady state EBITDA number. Hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, no, that, I understand. I guess more of a point was that if you exceed expectations with some of the initiatives and growth you're expecting with GoTo, we should expect that put option to increase.
Yes.
Possibly, yeah.
Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
We
Thanks
get
for the question.
Earnings as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, Liza.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Gracian for closing remarks.
Thanks everyone for your time, and I do want to reiterate and apologise again for that, for our extended suspension and the delay in releasing our results. It was an important thing to get done and get it done right, and we're looking forward to over the next few days having more in-depth questions and with shareholders and analysts. But everyone has our details, and if there's any further questions or follow-ups, please make sure you reach out. Take care and have a great Christmas, everyone.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.